They're at Mount Sinai. Good. Where did they get? At what section of the Old Testament did they arrive at Mount Sinai? Exodus chapter 19. Very good. All right. So they're at Mount Sinai, and while they're at Mount Sinai, they have their first census. What's the first numbering of the people, of the men for war? 600 and some thousand. Let's be a little more precise. 603, 550. Of those 603, 550, how many of them end up coming into the promised land? Two. Who were they? Joshua and Caleb. Good. So that's the first 10 chapters. Chapters 11 through 21, what's the S that you could remember the book with there? Sojourning. So they're sojourning in the wilderness for how many years? 40 years. You could also say at that particular section in the book, it's actually 38 years because they've already been in the wilderness for about 2 years. So it's 38, 40 years, somewhere in there. And in chapters 11 through 21, the Israelites complain how many times? Seven times. How are those seven complaints structured? Yep. Right, yeah, so it's got a certain kind of structure to it that Bible nerds, what's the word that Bible nerds will use for that? A chiasm. So it begins, it has like a parallel structure where it begins and ends the same way, or it goes A, B, C, and then it inverts that order, and then it goes the other way down in that parallel kind of way. So, all right, good. So they're wandering in the wilderness for that period of time. That's when the old generation dies out. Chapters 22 to 36, what's the S that we could remember the book with there? Yeah, they're setting up to finally enter into the promised land. And what geographical location are they in as they're preparing to enter? They're east of the Jordan, good. And what 2.5 tribes end up living in that area? Gad, Manasseh, Reuben, Gad, and half-tribe of Manasseh. Very good. All right, and so they're there on that side, and they're in the plains of Moab is specifically where they are. And so they would be able to see from across the Jordan River. You can imagine they'd be able to see Jericho, which is going to be the first place that they destroy in the book of Joshua. And so, so chronologically, as far as the story goes, Numbers gets picked up in the book of Joshua as far as the flow of the story. So what is the book of Deuteronomy? Because that's in between the two. Yeah, Moses' retelling of the law, the word Deuteronomy means second law giving. Not that it's a new law, but it's a recapitulation or a repeating of the law to the new generation. And I think there's some things that hadn't been revealed up to that point that do get revealed in the book of Deuteronomy, but it's a series of speeches that Moses gives to the people, and you can imagine them again looking out at Jericho, and here's Moses giving them these final warnings to not make the same mistakes that were made on this side of the Jordan, that when we cross over, let's do it the right way. So then the book of Joshua, for the most part, shows them doing what God asked them to do. But here we are in this final section of Numbers, and God has been preparing them to get ready to finally enter the land. So as this is the chart, we just kind of talked about that. All right, so as we just said, they're at the plains of Moab. Those are some of the references that shows us them being at the plains of Moab from chapter 22 through chapter 36. So it says again and again and again that this is where they are. This is the staging ground. They're finally ready to take the land. And in these final chapters, one of the things that you're going to see here, which we did see earlier as well, is God will say things like, when you enter, when you enter, when you enter. It's going to happen now. And you can imagine all the people being very excited that they're just on the brink of finally getting there. And I think for us, we need to be anticipating our promised land as well. This world that we live in, it's in the wilderness, but maybe even more precisely, we're in the plains of Moab right now. We're almost in the promised land. And that's why we would need a book like Deuteronomy, for example. What are some of the things that Moses was warning the people about so that they could fully conquer the land and they could fully take their inheritance like he wanted them to have. All right, so the outline of what we're looking at today, loosely, chapter 34 is the land divisions, which is going to be given more detail in the book of Joshua. Number 35 are the Levitical towns, and then 36 is some questions surrounding tribal inheritance that comes about because of the daughters of Zelophehad from chapter 27. So we'll loop all of that together. Anybody have any comments or questions just by way of introduction before we look at this text? All right. Let's start out then with these land divisions as they're dictated by God in chapter 34. Let's go ahead and start out by reading verses 1 and 2. There's going to be larger portions of these chapters that we don't read. But look at chapter 34, verses 1 and 2. The Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Command the people of Israel and say to them, when you enter the land of Canaan, this is the land that shall fall to you for an inheritance, the land of Canaan as defined by its borders." All right, so then you're getting ready to see the borders. And so he's describing here the boundaries for the 9.5 tribes. But notice that he says the land will fall to them. That God is going to make it so that when they enter the land, they're going to be able to conquer it. They're going to be able to occupy it. But do we know later on in the Bible, did they fully occupy the land? No. What book of the Bible sticks out to you the most as the one that shows us that they didn't fully occupy the land? Judges, right? Judges shows you at the beginning of the book that they didn't wipe out all the Canaanites, and because of that, they're going to be like thorns in their side. Does anybody know if the book of Joshua indicates that they didn't fully wipe out the Canaanites as well? It does. There's not a lot of verses that do it. Here's four or three of them. I think there's four or five total. But Joshua 15:63, 16:10, 17:12, you've got little hints of some of these things that really crack open in the book of Judges. And so they're not going to fully occupy this land that God said would fall to them, which means that they didn't fight for all God gave them. Can you think of any lessons or applications for us just from that? Right. Has God given us all the resources that we need to put sin to death? Has God given us all the motivations imaginable to make him the greatest pursuit of our life with the love that he's shown us and everything like that? He's made everything fall down. All the fortifications of the enemies, the motivations to fight against sin, he's made all of that accessible to us. And the question that we have to ask ourselves is, are we going to fight for all that he's given to us? The Israelites didn't. They do have times where they almost conquer all of this land. But here's the ideal boundaries for the borders of Israel. I'll have this picture up and it'll be a little bit bigger in just a moment. But verses 3 through 5 show the southern border. Verse 6 shows the western border. Verses 7 through 9 show the northern border, and then 10 through 12, the eastern border. And when you look at how this is recorded, seas or rivers, bodies of water, the Dead Sea, the Mediterranean Sea, these things dictate a lot of the boundaries, the water areas would, and that just kind of makes sense. But one thing to observe from this is who is deciding the boundaries of Israel? God is. Do you suppose that God had some wisdom about the land and he had some wisdom about the tribes? And based on what he knows, I think, about the tribes and the land, that he's orchestrating this and putting it in harmony like it ought to be. Now, can you guys think of any lessons that we could learn from that in how God operates? Good. Good. What else? Yes. That's right. Right. Does God know the makeup of a local church, and has he designated and chosen who the elders and the deacons are going to be, because these are men that have fit these roles, and then the other services that people render. Does God put that together in his good wisdom? Yeah. And so the Israelites would have to trust that about God as they were doing this. I think it's interesting in verse 13. Look at verse 13. Moses commanded the people of Israel, saying, "This is the land that you," not we, because he's not going to be part of it, "that you shall inherit by lot, which God has commanded to give to the nine tribes and to the half tribe." He's giving them instructions, or he's relaying information about stuff that he's not going to reap the rewards of. And again, I think we've noted before Moses' obedience after he failed in the book of Numbers. It's just really cool to see his earthly hopes dashed, but look at how he's still serving the Lord. Two times it says that the 2.5 tribes already received their land. They already got what they wanted, but here's how God is carving it up for the people that are going to go on the other side. Any comments or questions up through verse 15? Okay, so in order to allocate the lands, and they have to have like a committee that's going to work for that. So you've got leaders for this. These people are going to be nominated by God. He chooses the roles, just like he chooses the land. And Joshua and Eleazar are going to be part of this committee, but you also have Caleb. And Caleb was one of the ones that, of course, was faithful. He's, receiving the rewards of his fidelity to God. The other people that are listed, it would be 9 more people because there's the 2.5 tribes. 8 more people. Yeah, something like that. There's 8 people that are not otherwise known, but God is choosing these people that are going to be involved in the allocation of this land and setting the borders and showing how God has dictated all of that. And for whatever it's worth, the tribes are listed in verses 16 through 19, roughly from north to south. So God is making geographical sense like he so oftentimes does in the Bible. Anything that you guys want to say through chapter 34? All right, so that's like, it's kind of like, here's the big picture of how the land is going to be allocated. Then you dial in, and then you look at the Levitical towns that are going to be scattered throughout that land. So what are the Levitical towns? Look at Numbers chapter 35, verses 1 through 8. The Lord spoke to Moses in the plains of Moab by the Jordan at Jericho, saying, "Command the people of Israel to give the Levites some of the inheritance of their possessions as cities for them to dwell in, and you shall give to the Levites pasture lands around the cities. The cities shall be theirs to dwell in, and their pasture land shall be for their cattle and for their livestock and all their beasts. The pasture lands of the cities which you shall give to the Levites shall reach from the wall of the city outward 1,000 cubits all around. And you shall measure outside the city on the east side 2,000 cubits, and on the south side 2,000 cubits, and on the west side 2,000 cubits, and on the north side 2,000 cubits, the city being in the middle. This shall be belong to them as a pasture land for their cities. The cities that you give to the Levites shall be the 6 cities of refuge where you shall permit the manslayer to flee. And in addition to them, you shall give 42 cities. All the cities that you give to the Levites shall be 48 with their pasture lands. And as for the cities that you shall give them for the possession of the people of Israel, from the larger tribes you shall take many, and from the smaller tribes you shall take few, each in proportion to the inheritance that it inherits shall give of its cities to the Levites." All right. So, just a couple things about these cities. How many cities are there for the Levites? 48. And they're listed out in Joshua 21. You have the names of them, the locations of them in Joshua 21. What's the size of each one? 2,000 cubits by 2,000 cubits. And then you've got, like, what's in the very center of these territories? The city's at the very center. So it's 2,000 by 2,000 plus however big the city would be. So I don't know if that would be like 2,100 cubits by 2,100 cubits. I'm not sure however that would have looked. That's probably underestimating. But here's a diagram of what this would have looked like. So you've got the city in the middle, however much that would be, and then marking out from the city 1,000 cubits on any on all 4 sides. So it makes like a perfect square. Why do they need these 1,000 cubits going out? pasture land. Did you guys know that the Levites needed pasture lands? Like, they were sort of shepherds and farmers, I guess, as it were, too. They needed to do work like that, or they needed space to keep all of the animals that they had. All right, so of these 48 cities, how many of them were cities of refuge? Six. We're going to talk about what cities of refuge were for in just a moment. That's going to be the rest of this chapter. But here's an interesting statistic about these cities. When you do the math and you multiply how big each city was, or the territory for each city, and then you compare how big the promised land was, the Levites ended up having 0.1% of the promised land. About 15 square miles is what the Levites had. And so the Levites, like we've said, like we've seen this before. Well, let me get to this in just a moment. One thing to point out, verse 8, the larger tribes provided more cities for the Levites than the smaller tribes. So God, again, is being very equitable in those kinds of ways. But do you remember in Leviticus or Numbers 18 where it says that the Levites would have no inheritance in the land? So this is interesting because it seems like they have an inheritance in the land. So how do we make sense of God saying that they have no inheritance in the land, and then later in the same book he says, by the way, you guys have 48 cities? Right. Yeah, so they're scattered about. They don't have like a particular region that belongs just to the Levites. They're scattered all over the place. Cherry? Okay, good, good. Yeah, and maybe some other ideas with this as well. Like, could it just be that by comparison, the Levites really have nothing in the land compared to the big tribal allotments that other people had? Maybe that's the idea. Maybe another idea is that they're not really inheriting this land, they're just simply dwelling in it, but it was more in, but isn't that kind of like what the other tribes had as well? So maybe it, more so the idea is that they had no place that they all could congregate. But by God's design and God's wisdom, God was taking care of the Levites. How did he take care of them? By the tithes of the people, right? We talked about that in Numbers 18, that these people are acquiring the flocks from the tithes of the people. And so what happens if the Israelites were not faithful to God? What would happen to the priests and the Levites? They would be neglected. Are there any stories in the book of Judges where there's a Levite who doesn't seem to have much money, so he's willing to take any job he can find as a priest for somebody? Remember Micah in Judges 17 and 18? You've got like the last few chapters of Judges where it's like an appendix where it talks about the religious sin of the people and then the social sin of the people. You've got the two stories that emphasize those two aspects. Yeah, Cherry? Yes, exactly. If the Levites' job, in part, was to teach the people, the priests were to teach the people, well, what's one of the ways that you disseminate information when you don't have Zoom and all this kind of stuff back then? You have to have areas where all of these people live. So if people have got questions or whatever, you could go to one of these cities, I would imagine, or one of the Levites would walk out from the cities and go around and spend time with the people in the surrounding areas. But that was by God's design, that the scattering of the Levites would help bring teaching across the nation. Does that remind you of anything that happens in the book of Acts? The Christians, who are also known as priests, get scattered, and what do? Yeah, they preach the word. And so, and Cherry, did you have something else? That's a good point, yeah. Like the salt of the earth left, and so everything's just going to corrode at that point. Anything else you guys want to say about this? Yeah, Kay. Oh, yeah. Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, so it's like wherever they lived, like even in the place they lived was strategically designed by God for them to be able to be of service. But then you've got like other people that have got farms and stuff like this where they can take care of themselves. So it's like everything about these people, these Levites, was all about service in this way. By the way, where were the Levites originally selected by God to have this special role? Because originally, wasn't it going to be all the firstborn of the tribes that were going to be the Levite kind of people? Do you remember in Exodus 32, after they sinned at Mount Sinai, and Moses calls anybody to come and take up the sword and destroy the people that were committing idolatry? Who were the ones that picked up the sword? The Levites were. How many did they kill that day? 3,000. Contrast that with Acts chapter 2. So you've got the law being given at Mount Sinai, and the law brings forth death. And then in Acts chapter 2, you've got the new law being given, and the Spirit brings forth the life of 3,000 people. Same number. And in this instance, it's the true priests that are spreading the message of the gospel that's bringing life to people and everything like that. So there's some cool parallels with all of that. Okay, anything else you guys want to say up through verse 8? Okay, let's talk about the cities of refuge then. Let's go ahead and read verses 9 through 15. And the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Speak to the people of Israel and say to them, when you cross the Jordan into the land of Canaan, then you shall select cities to be cities of refuge for you, that the manslayer who kills any person without intent may flee there. The cities shall be for you a refuge from the avenger, that the manslayer may not die until he stands before the congregation for judgment. And the cities that you give shall be your six cities of refuge. You shall give three cities beyond the Jordan and three cities in the land of Canaan to be cities of refuge. These six cities shall be for you refuge for the people of Israel and for the stranger and for the sojourner among them, that anyone who kills any person without intent may flee there." Okay. So let's begin with this question. When would a city of refuge be needed? There's six of them. Three on either side. So it kind of goes in three steps. The first step is someone is killed. Now, it's particularly somebody who's killed by accident is really who these cities are for. But the second step is that this person who accidentally kills somebody flees to a city of refuge for protection from an avenger. Now, who are the avengers? What? Right. It's not the movie. It's like some kind of relative of somebody that, you know, if somebody accidentally killed Samantha or something, or one of my kids, and I was an avenger, I would be like, hey, like, that wasn't cool, I'm going to go after you, and that person could go to a city of refuge, and they would be protected in this city from this avenger. And what would be the purpose of the protection? Right, so that you could give a fair trial for the person that accidentally killed somebody. We can actually do this the right way. So this is an interesting thing, because the cities of refuge, they're not about ignoring justice. It's about making sure that justice is fairly given, so that you don't have like mob mentality saying, well, this happened and now we have to go ahead and kill these people. It's more like, well, let's do this in a calculated kind of way. Let's make sure that we're really doing justice the right way. Any comments or thoughts on those steps there? All right. So the locations of the city, these are designated in Joshua 20. So Joshua 21 has the 48 cities kind of in total. Joshua 20 is the one that has the six cities of refuge particularly. And how many of them are on the east side of the Jordan, where it's Reuben, Gad, and the half-tribe of Manasseh? You've got three on either side. And you kind of wonder, well, if it's only two and a half tribes on one side, why did they have the same amount as the 9.5 on the other side. Maybe the one side was going to have more accidents than the other. I'm not sure what the reason for that is. The size of the territory is kind of similar, but the east side is still bigger. The west side is still bigger. But the fact that God has allowed three cities of refuge on the east side of the Jordan shows what about the east side of the Jordan? Yeah. They were recognized by God. Now, was the origin of them asking to stay on that side a good thing or a bad thing? It's not what God originally intended. And as we said earlier when we looked at that section, these were the first people to go into exile. And so I don't think it was like a good thing that they wanted to settle for less than what God wanted. But at the same time, we see them being recognized as a legitimate place by God doing this. You also see in this text in verses 13 through 15 that these cities of refuge were for the Jews and Gentiles alike. Joshua 20 verse 9 says the same thing. That if you got a sojourner among the people or you've got a foreigner among the people, the Israelites were never supposed to act like the superior race and act like in some way or for some reason it would not apply to you, that these privileges belong to all of us because we're all made in whose image? God's. And so we don't push people down because they're a different ethnicity or they came from a different country or something like that. God has always been fair in showing equality to people in that way. Any comments or questions on that? Right. Yeah. And what's being talked about in our society right now are like, illegal immigrants, to use that term. But have you noticed that our society emphasizes like certain things that are good about equal human rights, but then we don't really talk about things like abortion so much? You know, like it's interesting. Ever since I've become a Christian, I've kind of tracked what the evangelical world is writing about in books. So like it used to be that the evangelical world was writing about our identity in Christ and what it means to be in Christ was what a lot of books were being written about. And then it shifted to books being written about hospitality. And now it's shifting to books that are being written about justice. And I've read parts of some of these books, and the only thing that it talks about are illegal immigrants and racial issues. Does that need to be talked about? Yeah, that needs to be talked about. But what these books, coming from people claiming to be Christians, never talk about is abortion. So, I don't know. I'm just leaving that out there. But God cares about equal human rights no matter what the human is. And we've got to talk about all those things. And we better not ignore one of them either. So, any comments or questions on any of that? All right. So, what the rest of this chapter does then is it shows cases of murder where the city of refuge would not apply. And then it talks about cases of accidents where the cities of refuge would apply. So look at verses 16 through 21. But if he struck him down with an iron object so that he died, he is a murderer. The murderer shall be put to death. And if he struck him down with a stone tool that could cause death and he died, he is a murderer. The murderer shall be put to death. Or if he struck him down with a wooden tool that could cause death and he died, he is a murderer. The murderer shall be put to death. The avenger of blood shall himself put the murderer to death. When he meets him, he shall put him to death. And if he pushed him out of hatred or hurled something at him lying in wait so that he died, or in enmity struck him down with his hand so that he died, then he who struck the blow shall be put to death. He is a murderer. The avenger of blood shall put the murderer to death when he meets him. All right. So how do you determine if it was murder and then therefore that the city of refuge would not protect this man? Motive. How do you determine murder and motive? Right. But even if, like, so if there's no prior grudge, he starts out by talking about the weapon that was used, right? So, like, if you use an iron object, a stone object, a wood tool, and you strike somebody with it, what is that pretty clearly showing your intent was? Yeah, to kill somebody. you know. But what if you didn't use a lethal weapon, but it was known that you had a grudge with this person? You know, like, if it was something that was done in hatred, or it was done with enmity, or you were lying in wait, hiding behind the bushes, and you had made a plan to go ahead and do something like this. If it was known, and it was, we're going to see at the end of this chapter that it requires witnesses, that if it was clear that there was some kind of hatred involved, then you were deemed a murderer. So if you pushed somebody, and that person hit a rock, and they hit their head on the rock, and they died from that, even if you didn't use a weapon, but it was clear that there was enmity and hatred, then that was considered murder. One lesson that I think we can learn from this is we better not live with grudges. If I'm always living, you know, being frustrated and angry with every single thing about every single person, and I say something mean about somebody or I have some kind of action towards somebody, won't everybody just automatically assume that that was done with intent? So that's, he's saying, you know, like, that's how people are going to look at this if you're kind of a grudgy sort of person. And so who is it that has to kill the murderer? The Avenger has to do it. Can you imagine being the Avenger? Like, you run to the city of refuge and you're like, no, this city of refuge does not apply to this man. Here's my witnesses. I'm bringing to you more than one and we can all testify. And then they do their court and they're like, okay, yes, this person should be executed. And the Avenger has to do it. If you were thinking about being an Avenger, would that make you think twice about doing that? Yeah. Would that make you want to be really careful about false accusations? You remember what happened with Naboth's vineyard? He gets worthless men, scoundrels, to go ahead and say that, yeah, Naboth did such and such, and so he deserves to die. All right, anything else you guys want to say about the cases of murder? Does it seem like a lot of countries have adopted some of these principles? Yeah, maybe. I mean, do these ones make sense? Yeah, like these are good ways of determining what your intent was and stuff like this. So I remember when I was taking my law classes, we were always talking about how to figure out motives of a crime and how the motive was such a critical part of how you were going to find somebody guilty or you were going to acquit them. So trying to read the mind of somebody, well, how do you do that? Well, you look at what objects did they use? And is there prior, did they have some kind of thing to gain from doing this? You know, so those are cases of murder, cities of refuge, no go for such a person. Let's move to the cases of accidents where the city of refuge was intended. And so in this situation, look at starting in verse 22. But if he pushed him suddenly without enmity or hurled anything at him, without lying in wait, or used a stone that could cause death, and without seeing him, dropped it on him, so that he died, though he was not his enemy and did not seek his harm, then the congregation shall judge between the manslayer and the avenger of blood in accordance with these rules. And the congregation shall rescue the manslayer from the hand of the avenger of blood, and the congregation shall restore him to his city of refuge to which he has fled, and he shall live in it until the death of the high priest, who was anointed with the holy oil. But if the manslayer shall at any time go beyond the boundaries of his city of refuge to which he fled, and the avenger of blood finds him outside the boundaries of his city of refuge, and the avenger of blood kills the manslayer, he shall not be guilty of the blood. For he must remain in his city of refuge until the death of the high priest. But after the death of the high priest, the manslayer may return to the land of his possession. And these things shall be for a statute and rule for you throughout your generations in all your dwelling places. Okay. How do you determine if it was an accident? Witnesses would be super helpful for this. What does the text say in verses 22 to 24 about it? There's no hostility. You hurled something at somebody without what? Yeah, you didn't notice that he was there. You're not planning it. So you pushed without enmity, hurled something without lying in wait. It wasn't planned. Or you accidentally dropped a stone on somebody's head. So, all right, how could you push somebody without enmity? Okay, so maybe you're like working on a construction site or something and like you lose your footing and you like try to grab for the nearest thing and you accidentally push somebody. Any other ways that you could push somebody without enmity? Like a big smile? Yeah, it could be something as simple as that. So you can think of scenarios where something like that would happen. You're like, I did not intend for it to happen like that, you know, sort of thing. You hurled something without lying in wait. When would you hurl something without lying in wait? Okay, yeah, maybe it's like throwing a spear and you thought it was the deer or something like that. You accidentally drop a stone on somebody's head, like you're at another work site, or I don't know what scenario that would be. You're climbing up a tree and you see, oh, look at the stone and drop, I don't know. But like you get these different scenarios where something like this could happen. And if it was a careless accident or you went too far while you were playing around or something like this, what's the procedure? The person that accidentally killed somebody has to live in the city of refuge for how long? Till the death of the high priest. Does that sound anything like our experience? What is it that allows us to be set free? The death of our high priest. And have we committed a lot of sins not knowing that they were really sins? I remember growing up doing all kinds of things that I didn't know were wrong until I became a Christian. I'm like, oh, that was all wrong. And so the death of the high priest is what allows us to be able to go free. So I think that's one cool thing to see with that. What happens if the manslayer leaves the boundaries that were dictated for him? Too bad for him. How big was the city? 2,000 by 2,000 cubits. So he's really confined to this area. If he's ever like, you know what, I'm just going to sneak out for right now. Is there any story with King Solomon where something kind of like that happens? Anybody remember? It was the guy that was throwing rocks at David when he was leaving, when Absalom, you remember his name? Shimei. When Shimei was, I don't think he like killed anybody, but he's kind of under the similar kind of house arrest. And he ends up going outside the boundaries because I think some of his donkeys flee or his servants leave or something like that. And when that happens, Solomon ends up putting him to death. So there's other stories kind of like that. So he's going to be killed if that happens. But notice how the punishment fits the crime for both scenarios. So if you murdered somebody, you intentionally killed somebody, your life will be deliberately taken by the avenger. But this is cool because if you by chance happen to kill somebody, you have to wait till the chance death of the priest for you to leave. So look at how fair God is in his laws. You compare this to things like the Code of Hammurabi, other laws that were written in the ancient world. This is a major step up from any other ancient law code on how fair God is in scenarios like this. Any comments or thoughts on that? Yeah, Cherry? Right. That's right. And if we go beyond the boundaries of what God has given us, if God has given us boundaries and he says, this is what you live in, is what my law says. Like, what is it, 2 John that says, if anybody goes beyond what Jesus has said, then they're committing sin. Yeah. Yeah. So when we get to Leviticus, chapters 4 and 5 especially, we'll talk more about that. But I don't know. What do you guys think? It's a good question. There's still punishment if it's accidental, right? So there's still at least a strong slap on the wrist. You get to live, but you've got to live in this city. I wonder if the person's family would move in there with them too. I don't know. Yeah, Janice? Right. Right. So if you've intentionally sinned, there's always the sacrifice of Jesus, right? That you go back to it. If you didn't know, and you find out you're kind of awakened to it, I guess it's kind of the same thing. You go back and ask for forgiveness because that's what we have. I remember when I had been a Christian for a year and a half when I met Samantha and taught her. And like after she had been a Christian for like a month or whatever, I would be asking her like, so what do you feel like you struggle with spiritually? And her answer for the first, couple months was like, I don't know yet because I'm still learning what's right and wrong. But as she would learn things, she'd go, okay, that needs to change and that needs to stop and all these kinds of things. So, Cherry? Yep. Right. 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 Yep. Yeah, and it's like even, I'm no expert with kids. Asher turns 6 on Saturday. But, like, you can tell when a kid does something intentionally wrong and when they really do make a mistake, And I think any parent that's perceptive to what's going on in their child's heart to the extent that they can see it is going to handle those situations differently. And so I think you see God doing that too here. So, all right. Kay, were you going to say something? Right. Right. Yes, he laid down his life for us. Yeah. That's right. Right. Yeah, very good. Good. Yeah, you wonder, like, what if the priest, what if it was like a newly anointed priest? And you're like, oh man, like wrong time to make an accident. You hope for an old guy. All right, look at verses 30 to 34. If anyone kills a person, the murderer shall be put to death on the evidence of witnesses, but no person shall be put to death on the testimony of one witness. Moreover, you shall accept no ransom for the life of a murderer who is guilty of death, but he shall be put to death. And you shall accept no ransom for him who has fled to his city of refuge, that he may return to dwell in the land before the death of the high priest. You shall not pollute the land in which you live, for blood pollutes the land, and no atonement can be made for the land for the blood that is shed in it, except by the blood of the one who shed it. You shall not defile the land in which you live, in the midst of which I dwell, for I, the Lord, dwell in the midst of the people of Israel. All right. So, God requires more than one witness. Deuteronomy 19 talks about how they can't be worthless kind of people. They, there's got to have some social standing to be a good witness. So, you've got that going on. And it's interesting, for both the murderer and the manslayer, the accidental death, what can both of them not do about their circumstances? They can't pay their way out. I love how fair God is. How frustrating is it sometimes in society where the really wealthy and the elite seem to get off with doing anything they want to do? In God's way of regulating the nation, if you were wealthy, you did not ever, if it was done God's way, you did not ever have legal privileges because of your wealth. And so the murderer, the only payment was his life. And for the manslayer, no accident could be ransomed with any amount of money. But one of the things that is talked about in the prophets, that the prophets would condemn the leaders for, is taking bribes and stuff like this. So they weren't doing what God's law told them to do. I can't think of the passages offhand where some of that kind of thing is mentioned. But that is something that the prophets do end up talking about. Verses 33 to 34 talk about defiling the land, that innocent blood pollutes the land. The blood of the guilty person that murdered brings atonement to the land. So what happens if you got a bunch of innocent deaths all over the land and God wants to dwell in this land with him? What's he going to do? He's going to bring judgment. If you're polluting my house, my territory, with not handling murders the right way by killing the murderer and stuff like this, if you guys don't exercise justice, then God's not going to tolerate a polluted land. And what section of Scripture does God pack up his bags and leave? Ezekiel chapters 8 through 11 is the famous section in the Bible where God just, he shows Ezekiel this tour of all the things that were happening in the temple, and then he says, I'm gone. because they've been polluting the land. So Jeremiah talks a lot about polluting the land as well. All right, anything else you guys want to say about that? Yeah. Yeah. I mean, like, how seriously does God take it when justice is not being served in an equitable way? Not mob mentality, but a calculated, righteous kind of justice. That's something that God has left governments in charge of. And if they're not doing that the right way, that's one of the reasons why the nation of Israel was exiled. It's one of the reasons why not just Israel, but in the book of Amos, you've got these nations surrounding Israel. What is it? The Philistines, who were engaged in slave trafficking and stuff like this, that it was just a crime against humanity, and it's not even God's chosen people, and they're going to be judged too for it. So some people say, well, God was only operating in the nations in these ways, judging nations in these ways, until Jesus came, and then it's kind of like free range. I don't think that's so much the case. I think God waits. We've seen this kind of theme in the Old Testament, that God waits for sin to be ripe, and then he does send judgment eventually. Janice? Right. 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 Yep. And it's like, you know, even I think it'll be okay if I say this. There's one political party that seems to be really concerned with abortion, and there's another political party that seems to be really concerned with social injustices for people who are adults and stuff like this. The Christian should care about both, which means that there's a sense in which the Christian will probably be rejected by people on both sides of the aisle. The gospel and the Bible create a different kind of person that doesn't fit into the worldly molds. And I think sometimes we get scared to talk about abortion. I've got family members that have had abortions, and I know the pain that those women have gone through because of those kinds of things. And so, like, one of the difficulties of talking about that is, what if there is somebody in the church that's done it? Like, I think oftentimes it's assumed that nobody in the church would have ever done something like that, so we can rail on that sin. And I think it's left people with, like, a bad taste in their mouth that we better not talk about this. There's always grace for whatever sin anybody commits. But abortion is wrong. And that's just not something that we hear talked about as much right now. But we've got to care about human life, whether it's in the womb or outside the womb. And not just be fixated on one political side of this kind of thing. The gospel creates a different kind of person. So, all right, anything else you guys want to say about that? All right, let's finish this out then by looking at the tribal inheritance. That this question that comes up because of the daughters of Zelophehad. Look at the initial question that is brought in verses 1 through 4. The heads of the fathers' houses of the clan of the people of Gilead, the son of Machir, son of Manasseh, from the clans of the people of Joseph, came near and spoke before Moses and before the chiefs, the heads of the fathers' houses of the people of Israel. They said, "The Lord commanded my Lord to give the land for inheritance by lot to the people of Israel, and my Lord was commanded by the Lord to give the inheritance of Zelophehad, our brother, to his daughters. But if they are married to any of the sons of the other tribes of the people of Israel, then their inheritance will be taken from the inheritance of our fathers and added to the inheritance of the tribe into which they marry. So it will be taken away from them, the lot of our inheritance. And when the jubilee of the people of Israel comes, then their inheritance will be added to the inheritance of the tribe into which they marry, and their inheritance will be taken from the inheritance of the tribe of our fathers." Okay, everybody get that? So, you've got people from what tribe coming? Did your guys just say Manasseh? From the clans of the people of Joseph. Yeah, okay. So you got Manasseh, Joseph coming to inquire. And what is their problem? Yeah. What was said about Zelophehad's daughter in chapter 27? When God was being so sexist? Yeah, Zelophehad had 5 daughters. He had no sons. The law stipulated that the land inheritance goes through the male, which means that the daughters, they would still end up with land, but it would be their husband's land that they get. So that's just, you had to carve it up some way, and that's how it was done. But if you had no sons and all daughters, what was said about the daughters in Numbers 27? What did they receive? Their father's inheritance. So these people are saying, all right, hey, question about this. I know what you said over there in Numbers 27 makes sense. It's great. But what if somebody from a different tribe marries these women, and then in the year of Jubilee, when everything gets reset and all the debts are canceled and everything and everybody goes back to their original territories, how are we going to figure out this mess that might happen? And so that's the concern that they have here. I like that these people are showing concern for their inheritance. You know, that's the way that they would have done it here. How much concern do we show for our inheritance? How much do we daydream about what heaven is going to be like? How much do we long to be with God in all of His glory? We've only seen a dim part of His glory, but we're going to be made to be like Him. Like, how much are we trying to think, what are the things in my life that could kind of tangle up my inheritance one day? Am I getting those things clear and figured out in my life? I like that these people are respectfully asking Moses a question like this. Here's the answer. Look at verses 5 through 9. And Moses commanded the people of Israel according to the word of the Lord, saying, the tribe of the people of Joseph is right. This is what the Lord commanded concerning the daughters of Zelophehad. Let them marry whom they think best, only they shall marry within the clan of the tribe of their father. The inheritance of the people of Israel shall not be transferred from one tribe to another, for every one of the people of Israel shall hold on to the inheritance of the tribe of his fathers. And every daughter who possesses an inheritance in any tribe of the people of Israel shall be wife to one of the clan of the tribe of her father, so that every one of the people of Israel may possess the inheritance of his fathers. So no inheritance shall be transferred from one tribe to another, for each of the tribes of the people of Israel shall hold on to its own inheritance. The daughters of Zelophehad did as the Lord commanded Moses. For Mahlah, Tirzah, Hoglah, Milcah, and Noah, the daughters of Zelophehad, were married to sons of their father's brothers. They were married into the clans of the people of Manasseh, the son of Joseph, and their inheritance remained in the tribe of their father's clan. These are the commandments of and the rules that the Lord commanded through Moses to the people of Israel in the plains of Moab by the Jordan at Jericho. So here's the answer. I like God says Joseph is right. Remember, that's the same thing that was said about the daughters of Zelophehad. They bring this concern. And God says, yeah, they're right too. There are different times in the Bible here where you've got like a general rule. The inheritance goes through the sons. That's the rule. Hey, we got this scenario that doesn't seem to fit like with that law. Like, how are we going to work with this? Oh, yeah, well, that's an exception. Here's how we're going to handle those exceptions. But you don't get that precedent until the scenario comes up. That's what case law is. The United States legal system was built off of a lot of case law from many, many years before that, and we got this precedent, and this is how it was handled. It seemed equitable. It seemed to make sense. So that's how we do this. And so in similar manner, you've got a couple scenarios in the Old Testament where you've got a new scenario where there's not a law that really fully addresses this. So you, in those moments, you get these laws for these exceptions. And so they say that Joseph is right, and what is it that the daughters of Zelophehad have to do? Yeah, they have to marry within their father's clan. Can you imagine being one of those daughters and you really had your eyes set on one of those Zebulunites or something? I don't know. And you're like, oh man, I can't marry one of them now? Does God have the right to regulate marriage and how it works and who can be remarried and all those kinds of questions? God has the right to do all of that kind of thing. I like, though, that the text says that they can still marry whom they think best in verse 6. Right, yeah, there's like no arranged marriage. Look at the dignity given to these women. They can marry whom they think best. It's got to be within the restrictions God gave, but you can marry who you think best. Well, can it be a Reubenite? No, it can't be one of those. But it's who you think best within the pool that God has given you. And if everybody approached marriage that way, I think things would be good. Yeah, Jerry? Right. Yes. Yeah, Moses is always, he's like, I'm not sure about that. Let me have some time with God and figure out a good answer to that. Good. Right. Yep. And you can imagine that based on what he's saying here, the tribal boundaries aren't going to have to be redrawn. I think one lesson to make from this is that I can't transfer my inheritance to somebody and people can't transfer their inheritance to me. You know, like my children won't be saved because of my righteousness, or they won't be lost because of my unrighteousness. Everybody is going to have their inheritance that they have to be show concern for. So I think that's one thing to consider with that. Cherry, were you going to say something? Yep. Yep. The book of Numbers ends on a high note of obedience. We hadn't seen that for a long time, but now it's happening again. I like to, that when these people ask a question, good questions lead to a greater understanding of how to handle things. It's one of the themes. I've been wanting to preach a sermon on this from the Gospel of Mark specifically. The times where the disciples ask questions and what it does for them when they ask questions. One of the big keys to Bible study is asking questions. Like if I came to you guys and I said, hey, I'm really wondering what Lamentations 2:14 means because of blah, 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 blah. What does that mean that I've been doing? I've been looking at it. If I never have a question about the Bible, it means one of two things. It means when I'm reading it, I'm not paying enough attention to it. Or number two, I'm not reading it. That's what it means. You know, and so it doesn't mean you have to ask other people your questions. You can ask yourself the questions and try to meditate on it and think about it. But if you never have questions, then it's like, are you really putting your mind to these things? Because everybody's got questions about something. And so I like that in the Bible, you've got moments people ask good questions. It leads to good things.